say this morning. All right, this is speaking through on anything. This morning I'm going to talk first about a little bit about principles of ecology. Then I would like to show in what ways we have perhaps failed to observe some of these principles and why we're in the predicament we're in. I think most of you have probably read about some of our problems. I really won't go into these in detail. I think you've probably read a good deal of what the predicament is, and I'd like to explain why we are, particularly why the use of DDT, for example, has been particularly harmful, and why some of these other particular problems do seem to be appearing. First, talking about ecology. Ecology basically is a study of living things in relationship to each other and to their environment. The environment then would include the physical factors, air, water, soil, and such. And then, of course, the interrelationship of the living things. So this essentially is our study of ecology. And in dealing with ecology, we speak about communities of living things. And this would be just like a human community. It would be plants and animals living together in this particular environment. And we find that the community life, more or less, reaches a type of equilibrium. In other words, plants and animals live, die, but they have relationships to each other, and it tends to reach a particular equilibrium. And when the equilibrium or this balance is upset, then you see there are vast changes that take place and very frequently a series of problems result. Well, there are two very important relationships that occur in any kind of community. And these are one, interdependence, and two, competition. Things are pretty essential for the balance and the well-being of the particular community. And let's take the first one of these, the interdependence. We find that plants and animals are very interdependent and none is completely self-sufficient. This is also true in a human society. You know well that there are only very few it would be virtually impossible to live completely, independent of all other people. For example, where to get your shoes from, and who takes care of you when you're sick, and so on. Where the food comes from, and the wood, and everything for your houses. So human society is very, in other words, we are dependent upon others. And likewise, in the society or community, again, we have interdependence, and along this line, too, we find that for food, there is interdependence. Certain animals eat other animals or plants otherwise. And going along with it, in the angle of food, we find that there is a so-called food chain, which we generally symbolize in the form of a pyramid. And the base of it are the producers. These are the photosynthetic plants. And if you notice, the base has to be much broader than the peak. So we need a large base of photosynthetic producers. If we do not have this, then we cannot support the animals that eat the plant or the animals that eat the animals that eat the plant. You see, each time you go up these steps, you must decrease the number. We find that the efficiency is cut down about 90% each time. In other words, if you had 100 calories, or let's put it 1,000 calories as a base for your photosynthetic organisms, the next lineup would only be a tenth of that 100 calories for it, and so on up. So you cut it down. The level above only gets 10% of the energy of the level below. So considering this, for maximum food efficiency, we would eat the plankton or the producers rather than what we are doing, the eating animals. So there's another aspect of this food chain, however, there is interdependence. In other words, certain animals eat the plants and then so on up. But another factor here, it is possible for certain things to concentrate in this particular food chain. And this is what actually has happened with DDT. Levels of DDT in water may be extremely low. Levels of DDT in plankton, extremely low. For example, a study, particular study that was made, they found that the level of DDT in the plankton was 0.04 parts per million, very low level. And yet, going up the food chain, they found that in some of the birds in the particular area, the concentration was more than 1,000 times. And this concentration is in the fatty tissue, meaning then that certain birds had more than 75 parts per million concentration of DDT. And you see, DDT has a very long half-life. It's here for at least 10 years or more. In other words, it's nothing that just disintegrates in a couple of days. So that we can have this gradual concentration. It is concentrated in the fatty tissue, and you see, as you go up the food chain, then certain organisms can have a much higher percent. It's also of interest that we find that there is DDT in the fatty tissue of virtually all animals, whether they have been in the vicinity of DDT spray or otherwise. So it's not something that, well, they just spray it in California, which I don't have to worry about it. This is not true. It's a worldwide problem. So this is one aspect in which the food chain can bring out certain problems here. Getting back to our communities now and the relationships we have as interdependence, also we have competition. Competition is absolutely essential in a particular community. Nature puts down many more seeds than can possibly survive. I'm sure you're familiar with this. You know that the amount of pollen produced by a tree, for example, copious quantities. And if all of this pollen fertilized then flowers, then if all these seeds germinated, we could be overrun by whatever it has to be. Just a rather homely example of the fact that nature does produce many more seeds than could possibly survive. Supposing we started with two houseflies, and we'll start with these in the spring sometime, March or April. And supposing now that every single one of these, of the progeny of these houseflies would survive and all of their children and grandchildren would survive. How many flies would we have by the end of the season, sometime October and November? We'd find an incredible number of flies, something like 1 times 10 to the 17th power, 17 zeros after that. And how many flies is that? Oh, it sounds like a lot, and we could write it off, but really, how many flies is that? It would cover the surface of the earth 47 feet with flies. So obviously, we don't have quite that many flies, although you may wonder some days around here, but, you know, I do fly. But there aren't quite that many. Why? Competition. Only the fit survive. There's competition both among flies between the species and between, in other words, in the species and outside the species. There is competition. Same type of thing with all kinds of organisms, many, many more seeds produced and can possibly survive. How many eggs does a queen bee produce in her lifetime? Incredible number. So competition is absolutely essential, and it has kept down population as far as your wildlife is concerned. It will bring up the problem this afternoon with what happens when suddenly we don't have these natural checks and balances, and this seems to be the problem we're getting into.
for a human population. But at any rate, we do have the competition. Rather interesting, occasionally in nature, an imbalance does occur, and there is a breakdown of the natural balances for a short period of time. One example, this is the red tide. How many of you are familiar with red tide? Any of you from California coast area, also the Gulf Coast, Florida? Red tide, rather interesting phenomenon. It is a case in which a very overbalanced condition occurs. In other words, normally you have a balance in the plankton that are present in the ocean, but certain times when the nutrients reach a certain level, when the temperature of the water again reaches a certain level, it means that a certain microorganism can apparently compete too successfully. It knocks out the diatoms and results in a very, very high population of a particular microorganism called a dinoflagellate. These are microscopic organisms. They're photosynthetic, and they're perhaps even smaller than diatoms. They can be observed under the microscope. These increase in tremendous numbers, such that just a teaspoon of water will contain numerous members of this particular microorganism. What happens during the red tide? They become extremely abundant, so abundant that the water actually is murky and red in color, hence the name. Also, accompanied with this is a very distinct odor of dead fish and other organisms. This vast population then of dinoflagellates cuts out nutrients in the water, resulting in death of other organisms, plus the appearance, production of toxic substances that kills many of the fish and other organisms. So you've got then this water with thousands and thousands of these dinoflagellates. This is an imbalanced condition. And rather interesting, however, in this particular state is, if you go there in the evening, the dinoflagellates are bioluminescent, and they will actually, whenever you have disturbance of the water, then you have this fantastic bluish glow. And there are so many of these organisms that are even in the sand all over. You can write your name in the sand. Wherever there's disturbance and oxygen is introduced, then you get this luminescence. So red tide would be an example of a kind of imbalance. It's rather interesting, it is increasing in amount, particularly in the Florida coast. Apparently, red tide outbreaks were relatively few and far between back in the early 1900s. I think it was around 1916, another in 32 and 45. Then in the 50s and 60s, they appear to come almost every year or every other year. What causes the red tide? Apparently, it is influx of fresh water plus certain nutrients that are introduced, and conceivably our contamination or pollution of streams has contributed to this because it has changed now the type of water that is flowing into the oceans. Well, this is one example of the imbalance condition resulting in death of many, many organisms. One thing about our cultivation scheme, we cultivate many crops. This is a simplification of a natural community, or making even an artificial type of thing, but such that we cultivate, in most cases, only one crop. And normally, the natural communities have many, many organisms interacting, and this is a much healthier situation. When you have only one crop, then you're inviting trouble, because it means that very soon you will have a parasite on this one crop, and it is extremely difficult to continually grow this one crop without outside problems. And this is what why we have the problem with the pests, and this has been why now we have to use the pesticides, so that the only way you can save the crop is with the pesticides. And then, unfortunately, we have used pesticides like DDT. And now, how do you stop using them when you have already built up a type of dependence problem in along this line is that the insects develop a resistance to the particular pesticides they're using. We find that organisms, those that survive, are resistant, you see, to whatever you're using. There is variability in any natural population, whether it be bacteria, whether it be insects, or whatever you're after. And there are going to be a few organisms that are resistant to whatever you're using. And these will survive, and this resistance, you see, they'll give to their progeny. And so pretty soon you have a whole race of resistant insects or bacteria, whatever it be. So then you have to up the dosage to kill off, you know, most of these, but then probably there are a few more that are resistant. And this is why we have been having to increase dosages. Same thing occurs in bacteria. Use of antibiotics can, again, create a similar type of problem. We find that in any given population of bacteria, assuming it's large enough, there will be bacteria that are resistant to some of these antibiotics. Okay, you take an antibiotic, you wipe out 90%, but maybe there are 10% that are resistant, and pretty soon you've got all the bacteria left that are resistant to a particular antibiotic in use. This is why it is, you cannot put antibiotics in the open market. You can see the problem. Everyone and their cousin would be guzzling down antibiotics, and what about them? They would be absolutely useless because all the bacteria surviving would have been resistant to these, and they would need to be a sugar pill, you know, you wouldn't even get any energy from them. So this is one of the problems, the fact that the organism develops resistance to the particular things that we are utilizing. Rather interesting in bacteria, interesting thing, rather surprisingly, does occur. We find that this resistance is transferable, not only from genus to genus, but even between genera. We have inside our intestinal tract a particular bacterium that's normally there. It's a, we expect it there. It actually does perform a useful function. Nevertheless, if we guzzle down a whole bunch of different antibiotics, the bacterium in our intestinal tract is going to be resistant to these. It would have to be, otherwise it's completely wiped out. Well, it is a known fact that this resistant bacteria then can transfer its resistance to other bacteria. Supposing now you go to Mexico or somewhere and follow some typhoid bacilli. What happens? Your resistant bacteria in your intestinal tract can confer its resistance to the typhoid organism. So this is another rather frightening thing to realize. Again, in line with this idea of simplification of the environment, take for example, Illinois, University of Illinois, used to be lined with elm trees, you know, up and down the lines, nothing but elm trees all the streets. Well, along came the Dutch elm tree disease, and what happened? It wiped out the elm trees, and then when we were there, it was, instead of elm trees, there were stumps up and down the path and the streets, nothing but elm stumps. Well, they don't look so good. They're nice in the culture of mushrooms, and we had our fill of those. But other than this, you know, stumps sort of leave something to be desired. So we better put some trees in. What did they do? They decided, they must have had a concession from the nursery on honey locust trees. But what happened was, honey locust trees lined up and down, and nothing but honey locust trees. So the standing joke was, had they heard about the honey locust blight that was coming. But you can see the problem. If you have one crop, because all you need is, you know, along comes a parasite, and you wipe everything out. And trees, incidentally, the roots underneath the soil contact one another. And no matter what you do up above, you will still transmit the disease from down below. You just can't start to plant, you know, the same thing line after line. You're in for trouble. Okay, getting back now to some of these other ideas of ecology, the environment. Let's mention a few aspects of the environment and how this can also be a problem. Take, for example, air. Our air is largely nitrogen and a certain amount of oxygen, and actually a very low percentage of carbon dioxide, and then a few other things, including pollutants and otherwise, which I'll mention. But first off, let's just mention a little harmless thing such as carbon dioxide. And the percentage we have of carbon dioxide is relatively low. Yet, our present activity, increased population of animals, burning of fossil fuels, all of these things is increasing the content of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Well, what about that? Carbon dioxide is a substance that tends to absorb certain rays of radiation. And the light coming in from the sun, radiation coming in from the sun, hits the Earth's surface and bounces off in the infrared range. And the carbon dioxide tends to absorb this particular range. What do we have then? The so-called greenhouse effect. In other words, the potential of heating up is there as a possibility. Chuck the car up sometimes on a normal day, a sunny day. What happens when you open the door? It's like an oven, really hot. This is the greenhouse effect again. The glass is the same way as carbon dioxide was. Well, in other words, there is a potential of heating up in the environment. What would be the consequences if it should heat up? There's another way of heating up too, which you're going to realize this afternoon when we talk about population. But at any rate, as a potential of heating up, what could happen? We have a lot of ice and snow in the polar regions, Greenland, ice cap, and otherwise. What would happen if we were to melt all of this ice and snow? Well, the estimate is, among other things, the sea level would raise perhaps 200 to 300 feet. Well, supposing that were to happen, it means that either a lot of us are going to have to move to the top of Mount Whitney and Mount Rainier, or else we're going to have to get houseboats and live on the ocean, you see, because a lot of areas of the U.S. are going to be inundated. You may have to try building dikes like Holland, but anyway, there's going to be a problem, as you can see. All right, that's just carbon dioxide. What about some of these other substances? Incidentally, nitrogen can be converted by bacteria into usable nitrate for plants. This is one of the cycles that we have in nature. Incidentally, these are important too, and again, an aspect in which man has sort of interrupted to an extent. Nature normally recycles her waste. In other words, the urea, the waste is broken down by your bacteria, recycled into usable nitrates, and then the plants use them up again to produce amino acids and protein and so on. You've got a regular cycle here. What about man? We come along and we produce things, but what do we do with them? We just give them a toss and we do not recycle them. And then you've got a problem. If nature had not recycled her waste, you would go in the woods back here and there'd be so many dead trees all piled up. You'd have an awful job hiking through. But what happens to the dead trees? They're the bacteria, the fungi break these down to humus, and you've got a nice soil there rather than just rock and then pile up trees and dead leaves and otherwise. But man is failing to do this, and now we've got a real problem. How are we going to dispose of waste material? But what about oxygen? This obviously is essential, but when we cut down plants and forests and we remove a good deal of our vegetation to build houses and concrete, we are may produce some other problems too. Incidentally, it is plants that use up the carbon dioxide, and when we have fewer plants, again, more carbon dioxide. Some of the other pollutants, smog, for example, I'm sure you've heard a lot about L.A. smog and otherwise. I am from the L.A. vicinity. Actually, we're out of Los Angeles, but nevertheless, we're quite familiar with the problem here. And just along the freeways, for example, where the level of smog is getting increasingly higher, certain freely, and you can have crops of lettuce and leafy plants no longer survive. The forest, San Bernardino forest, are beginning to die. The pine trees are being seriously harmed because of the level of smog. When we first came to the area, driving along the Crest Highway, up above the smog, you could look down, you couldn't even see below it. You know, it's just a, just a really thick cover which you couldn't even see through. And then when you first enter into it, you start choking. You wonder how anyone can survive in it, and I still wonder in certain of the bad areas. LA people will tell you there's no problem, but this is not really true. Many days you can, it's really thick, you can see across the street, but maybe not much more than that. School kids, many days, can't go out to play outside. Why? You just cannot exercise in this kind of an environment. You just choke up, you can't play tennis, you can't run around, you just sit quietly and hope to get as much air as you can uncontaminated. What's in the future? In other words, are we going to have to wear gas masks or what? In the valley, this is extending out into the valley from Los Angeles. Where we first moved, it was described to us when we were in Illinois. You'll love it out there. There are only 10 days out of the year that we have smog. Well, we moved from there 4 years later. At the time in which there were only 10 days a year, there was no smog. Complete reversal. Very short period of time. So this is another one of our problems, smog, and many cities throughout the country have it, and it's an increasing problem. We've got to do something about it. There's much, much talk, but very little action. Always committees to discuss the problem, but you see, very little is done. Perhaps devices on new cars, but what about the old cars that are ignored and leave us? A real problem. Radiation can be another problem, particularly for things that, again, have a longer half-life. Something as seemingly innocuous as a cigarette can also be a potential pollutant, not only to yourself, but to the people in the room. I have a rather interesting thing. It came from Science, December 67. Few people point to the most damaging source of air pollution, the cigarette. And then mentions carbon monoxide, one of the toxic products of the automobile, carbon monoxide. And concentrations of carbon monoxide as high as 100 parts per million often occur in garages, tunnels, and behind automobiles. Such concentrations are tiny in comparison to those found in cigarette smoke, 42,000 parts per million, which expose smokers and non-smokers to toxic hazards. Nitrogen dioxide, another pollutant. So on. Some of the, again, source of air pollution. Let me go on now to talk about 10 more minutes. Let me mention some of the other aspects. Soil is another one in which we are potentially creating a lot of problems. Take, for example, the soil that we have in the tropics. This is known as a laterite soil. It's a rather interesting kind of soil. It's rather red, and it has very high concentration of iron and aluminum oxide. As far as usable nutrients for plants, virtually none. It's a very poor soil. It's highly leached. In other words, the nutrients have been washed out. It is oxidized because it occurs in warm climates, and you'll have, I imagine it's pretty good for iron ore or aluminum ore, but for growing things, extremely poor soil. It is also very nice for making bricks. In other words, it has been used for building material. Expose it to the atmosphere, add some water, and you've got a beautiful brick pavement. Okay, this is the soil we have in a good many of the areas in the tropics. Well, Army Corps of Engineers decided, well, some of these tropical areas, what's the matter with them? Why don't they start cultivating some crops, like we do up in Iowa and such. And so they cut down a lot of the existing tropical vegetation and decided to plant some crops. And it was fine. So for about the first year, but after that, none of the laterite has about enough nutrients in to support one crop, perhaps two, that's about it. After that, I would have got a beautiful brick pavement, but nothing much as far as cultivating things. In the Mekong River Valley, they do have a laterite if they have been able to grow rice crops year after year. Why? Because, only because of the fact that there is, quote, serious flooding every year. This flooding produces a veneer of topsoil on the in the valley area and has enabled them to grow rice year after year. Supposing now we dam up the river and prevent this harmful flooding, what happens? You may wonder, well, how does the tropical vegetation grow in the laterite soil? This is something that's been growing for many years, and studies have found that the roots of the tropical plants have a symbiotic relationship with fungus. In other words, there is fungus associated with these roots, and the fungus has enabled, given enough nutrients that they have been able to survive. And if certain of these tropical plants have been demonstrated, they will not grow without this fungus relationship. Supposing now we chop down the vegetation, we destroy the fungus relationship. It takes many, many years to develop. And what have we got? Problem. Water. Here's another problem in which dumping pollutants into water has been a serious problem. Pollutants could be organic, inorganic substances, or even heat. Heating up water can be a problem. We find that studies with just the common old fruit fly, we know that if you increase the temperature from basically room temperature, of course it depends on whose room it is and when, but let's say about 70 degrees Fahrenheit to 80 degrees Fahrenheit, the life cycle changes rapidly. In other words, you've got a much quicker life cycle when you raise the temperature. This means you need more food, respiration is speeded up, you need more oxygen, and metabolism is basically speeded up. What about this? If we raise the temperature of streams, many fish can't survive in the higher temperatures. Others require more food when there's less food, require more oxygen when there is actually less oxygen. We know that if you heat water, oxygen evolves. You have your maximum percentage of oxygen when your temperature of the water is low. You raise the temperature of the water, you evolve oxygen out. So this is going to create a problem. Another problem is adding pollutants to lakes and streams. This quickly changes the life history of a lake. Normally, a lake does have a life history, so it's data from its birth to death, and the death of a lake may take perhaps 10,000 or more years normally. Supposing we dump things into the lake, what happens? You may change the death of a lake to about 100 years or less. What happens when we dump things into a lake or stream? Supposing they're organic things, it can be broken down. Bacteria work on these and start producing products of decay and otherwise. But for these bacterial activities, oxygen is necessary. And the result is you're going to produce an anaerobic or stagnant condition. And you're going to accelerate this with more and more stuff being degraded and broken down and introduced into the lake. There's going to be less and less oxygen. And so ultimately, you're going to have this process occurring. Eutrophication, the term for this, a condition in which the lake is being overloaded with substances. It will normally happen in a lake in any region. In other words, vegetation is going to fall in from the sides and will be broken down. But when we dump stuff in, then we're greatly accelerating or speeding up this particular process. So here it is where we can have a particular problem. Also, we can get concentrations of certain organisms. Instead of the red tide, you may have blooms of certain types of algae, which can may be harmful and toxic. So this can be a problem. Photosynthesis, incidentally, is necessary for life. And anything that we do that cuts down photosynthesis can be a potential problem. What about this? If it were not for photosynthesis, we would not be here. It's one most fundamental process really, as far as life is concerned. If we were looking for life on another planet or other, we might look for photosynthesis. Well, are there any things that are potentially cutting down photosynthesis? Yes. DDT, for example, is known to cut down photosynthesis. What could happen? I've heard some biologists even go so far as to predict that within 10 years the ocean could essentially die because of the use of substances that could cut down photosynthesis. So here, too, could be a potential problem. One last thing I might mention is fire. You think of fire as being harmful and otherwise. Fire prevention programs in some cases have not been the best. For example, in the southwest area of the United States where it is traditionally quite dry, the area has normally, in other words, without man's intervention, there are probably fires there that occur maybe every 3 to 4 years or at least every 7 years. This means that these fires go through rapidly, they burn out the underbrush, but do not destroy the big trees. In other words, the fires come frequently enough just to clean out the underbrush, and they are not terribly destructive. But with a fire prevention program, preventing fires in some of these areas for as many as 20 years, what happens? You have a tremendous growth of underbrush otherwise. But then, supposing a fire does start, it's pretty hard to prevent fires in some of these areas. It's extremely dry in the fall of the year. And that wood is just like kindling, and lightning or otherwise, it's got a fire. What now? With all of this underbrush, you see, the fire can get so hot that it destroys everything. And this has been some of our problems here, too. It has changed very much the type of trees that we have in the area, and we call aspects of it. So a very destructive fire can occur. Center of interest that certain trees, certain pine trees, will not reproduce unless there is a fire. The key to the fire is necessary to open the cones and to enable reproduction. So fire, we think of it as being catastrophic in many cases, but in some areas it is essential for survival. So you see all these incidents. Okay, I'm going to stop here now, and we'll have a few minutes for any questions, discussions, or otherwise, and then your coffee break. Thermal inversion, yes. This is typically one of the problems in the LA area. What happens is that we have hot air above the cold air below. In other words, in the LA area, it's extremely bad. You are surrounded by mountains. In other words, here's the ocean air, cool air directly near the ocean blows into the land, and then it stops, you see. There are these mountains here that prevent further blowing of it. So you've got a cold air down here. But then the higher air current coming from the tropical region, Hawaii, bringing in warm air up here. So you've got warm air here, you've got cold air here. What happens? Normally, warm air is lighter, it rises. Well, the warm air is up here, you see. And the cold air is heavier, it sits. So you've got this cold air sitting here, and the warm air above means you don't get circulation because you're blocked here by the mountain. Well, what happens? Maybe no problem, except for man, we then have our automobiles and industry that spill out all these pollutants into this lower, cooler air, and it sits. There's no circulation. And we've heard wild schemes of drilling holes in the mountains so you can get circulation through, but no. The only solution really is to cut down the pollutants. You can't drill holes in the mountains or have a big fan on the top of the mountains. It's just not for it. Probably could be harmful. I don't know statistically or any studies that have been made, but I can imagine that all of this stuff on the plants would could virtually stop up the pores and prevent photosynthesis of those particular plants. I can't see how a plant could be covered with oil and possibly function, because you see the leaves have pores, and these would be pores enable the influx of carbon dioxide, which is one of the essential ingredients for photosynthesis. Plus, you also need the light, and that would cut out the light. So I would think any coating of oil would certainly be harmful. And of course, we know that it kills many of the fish otherwise.
Yes,
mixing of species in a natural setting helps prevent this, you know, like?
In other words, it's a little more difficult for a parasite to take over in such great numbers because there aren't so many of that one thing for it to attack. And you somehow meet, and there would be more predators. You see, there'd be predators on that. And you tend to reach a balance. When there are no predators and you just have one type of thing, it's very artificial and apparently does produce this is true, perhaps for two reasons. One would be that they are growing something that would normally be present in the area. I mean, it is apparently a fairly ecologically sound type of thing that they have been able to. But I imagine they still do have a certain problem with pests. But one of our principles of ecology in growing something in a particular area, you are smartest to grow something that is, you know, adaptable or fits very well. For example, in California, we have a native black walnut. And when we use black walnut roots and then graft an English walnut on, we have quite a fair amount of success because it's, you know, semi-native and picks something that is normally grown there and fits in well.
Radio on the way out here, we heard that in Illinois, one of the officials was wanting to declare an emergency because of the parasite on corn. I was wondering if it was because it was sort of a one crop area.
I'm sure this certainly increases the problem. Because then, you see, they can be completely wiped out if something happens. This is what happened in Ireland. They had a mainstay of potato back in the 1800s, and along came the fungus, late blight of potato, and wiped them out for, you know, severe famine in the 1800s.
I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
Oh, heating up of the atmosphere, and right. There are other aspects that could be influential. Yes, ozone does tend to cut out a certain amount of the radiation. We know this, and also the contrails from jets and all this. So what's going to happen, we don't know. As all we can probably state is that there will be a change, and it may or may not be detrimental. Some people claim that perhaps first will be this other aspect of cooling down because of the smog, increased smog and contrails from jets and otherwise. So yes, this is another aspect, and to be perfectly frank, there are two schools of thought in what's going to happen. We really don't know on Earth. But cooling down could be a problem too, because then you could cut down photosynthesis, less light coming in. So here's another big problem.
Thank you.
frequently in